Hi, my name is Benjamin Van Allen. I wrote episode 8, Familiar, of season 11 of The X-Files, and you're listening to The X-Cast.
Everyone, and welcome to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm Tony Black, your host, and instead of covering an episode today or a X-Files based topic, I've got a very, very special guest on with me today to discuss his role in producing the X-Files during the 90s and beyond, and all his amazing work since. It's a delight to speak to Mr. Frank Spotnitz. Welcome, sir.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
It's really nice to speak to you. As I was just saying off air, it's I think everyone listening to this will be really excited to hear your thoughts about the show and about your career and everything like that. And I suppose I'm going to put you on the spot slightly to begin with, because we do every time we have a new guest on, we try and do something called the Five Questions of X.
Okay.
In which we ask the guest various little questions about their fandom and things like that. But for you, obviously, it will be tailored towards The X-Files and your, you know, big involvement of it in it. So, okay. So the first question is: normally we would ask, when did you first discover the X-Files? But for you, and I know it's a story you would have told before, but what was your first involvement really in the X-Files, and how did it all come to be?
Okay. Well, I'll try not to make the answer too long, but I had been in a book group in Los Angeles with Chris Carter before the X-Files, when he was writing TV movies for Disney. Yep. But I'd fallen out of touch with him. And I remember very distinctly, I was at a friend's apartment in Los Angeles on a Friday night, and there was a TV on, and I saw in the background, created by Chris Carter, and I went over to the TV, and it was The X-Files, and I'm not sure if it was the pilot or one of the first few episodes, but I didn't know, you know, that he'd gone on to create the show and that it was on the air. So after that, I began watching. But I watched every week. I loved the show. And then, but I didn't call him. I just watched as anybody would. And then toward the end of the first season, a friend of mine whom I'd known since I was a kid in Phoenix, Arizona, who was also living in Los Angeles, trying to make it as a writer, called me and said, "Don't you know that guy, Chris Carter?" I said, "Yeah, I do. We were in book group together, you know, a few years ago." And he said, "Well, will you call him for me? I have some ideas I would like to pitch for episodes." But gosh, that's really awkward. I haven't called him myself, but I had known this guy a long time. So I sort of, you know, overcame my feelings of discomfort, and I called Chris, and he took my call, and I said, "Will you hear my friend's ideas?" And he said, "No, I won't. But if you have any ideas, I'll hear yours." and that's honestly, that's how it all came about.
Am I right in remembering correctly that it was Endgame was the first major credit, or was the one before that?
Yeah,
season two.
Yes. What happened was I shared a credit on Colony with Chris and right. David, and then Endgame was my first solo. And what happened was, Endgame was meant to be a single episode with this giant submarine conning tower poking through the ice. And when the studio and the producers in Vancouver saw my script, they thought I was insane and should be fired. because you obviously can't afford to do that on a television schedule or budget. And then it was either Chris's genius or Bob Goodwin, the producer in Vancouver. But they realized what they could do is make it a two-part episode, so you amortize the cost of that submarine over two episodes instead of one, and that the episodes would be broadcast during the February sweeps period, which is really important for the ratings, advertising rates. So I didn't get fired, and that became my first.
Yeah, and you kind of then went on to be, in many ways, the steward of the X-Files mythology, didn't you, for years, really. You know, looking at the episodes you wrote,
yeah,
you know, you were involved in the majority of the major, particularly the two-part middle episodes, you know, in the third series onwards. So that I'm kind of getting away from my five questions here, but that's fine. Did you sort of take on that? Did you want to take on that? Was that something that you were really keen to run with?
It's funny because the credits are really misleading about my role in the show, because I never worried about credits or putting my name on episodes when we were doing it. I loved the show and just wanted to get the work done. So I was, of the many hats I wore on the show, I think the most important one was that I led the writer's room. And so I really worked on all the episodes and breaking the stories, and sometimes, to a much larger degree than others, but I never put my names on those episodes. The ones I did put my names on tended to be the mythology ones with Chris. So yes, it's true. I was across the mythology all those years, but I think I was equally or even more so across all the standalones.
Yeah, and this is something obviously people don't always see, do they? When they're watching a TV show, and then they see, some people won't even pay attention to the name of the credit, if they're watching it quite, passively. But then even people who are watching the episode and see written by, Frank Spotnitz or written by Chris Carter, they may not always know that people are doing lots of work behind the scenes,
yes,
producers especially, to make that into an even better product.
That's exactly right. It was a hugely collaborative enterprise, doing 24 episodes a year. So we would have six, sometimes eight writers in that room, and we'd be breaking stories. And it was like, that was the laboratory where all the stories were devised. And then we would take them to Chris, who would give his notes or sometimes reject them or send us back the drawing board. But he was the final arbiter of the stories. But I loved that process. I still do. It's one of my favorite parts of doing this work.
And one of the things that having watched the season 11 Blu-ray, which has come out in the UK recently, you see that they still use the corkboard method.
Yes.
With the cards and everything like that. And that's fantastic. Do you feel that's something that is unique to that writer's room to this day? Or is it something that you've carried on, or something that you know of other writers' teams do?
My understanding is that it was Glenn Morgan and Jim Wong who brought that system to the X-Files in season one. And then it was adopted by Chris and Howard Gordon and Alex Gonzo and the other writers. And it was the way we did all the 10-13 series, not just X-Files, Millennium and Lone Gunman and Harsh Realm. But since then, it has spread out, not least because not just me, but Vince Gilligan and Howard Gordon and John Scheiben, all of us continue to use that system. And so all the writers who've gone through writers' rooms on all those shows, have also been exposed to that system. And I live and work in Europe now. I have for the past 8 years, and I use that system here, and I've been teaching in Berlin for 5 years, and I teach that system there. So it's spreading to a lot of places.
That's great, though, because I was wondering that when I was watching that Blu-ray. I was wondering how much is this extended beyond the show and things like that. So, it proves that it started something really, really interesting there. Do you ever, thinking of producing that many episodes you mentioned earlier, do you ever look back at now, especially in the age where a lot of TV shows are produced to, say, 10, 13 episodes, do you ever look back and think, how did we do it? How did we get all that done?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it was... the truth is it just chewed up my life. There was about 8 years where I had no life. I was just at work all the time. It was, 12-hour days minimum, and it was 5, 6, 7 days a week. And you really got no holiday because you were usually writing over the Christmas break. And then, one season would end. You'd kind of finish your work in the beginning, middle of May. But then you had to be back with a new writer's room at the beginning of June. So you're spending those 2 weeks between seasons, getting ready for the new season, hiring writers if you needed to hire new writers and so on. So it was incredibly hard work, and I would have been really grateful to only have to do 10 or 13. But having said that, I look back on it and I feel like, that was my first job in television. And I was incredibly green in the beginning. And it was like my second film school, and the privilege really of getting to tell that many hours of stories your craft as a writer gets developed and honed, you know, and strengthens very rapidly. It has to keep pace with the schedule. So it was, it's not something I would want to repeat, but, but I'm eternally grateful for the experience.
Yeah. Quite a few people have said that over the years, haven't they? That it was a real school of learning, you know, on the job every day. So it must have helped you, you know, in terms of getting to the point where in 2013 you created Big Light Productions and then were able to pass all that, a lot of that knowledge and a lot of that experience on to, you know, successive generations of writers and things like that. It must have been a massive, you know, help in that way.
Absolutely. I think Chris was not only had a very clear vision for the show, but he also demanded that you do your best work. You know, he insisted upon it. And really, you weren't going to stay if you didn't do that. And he taught me that, you know, you can never try hard enough. You can never be smart enough. His level of ambition was so high. And I carry those lessons with me in everything I do. So it was really, you know, the best job I could have ever hoped for. And I know Vince, who's a friend of mine to this day, feels the same.
Yeah, and what you've both gone on to create afterwards is, you know, is a testament to that. It's fantastic. So I'm going to go back to my five questions. These may just take through the episode, to be honest, as I go off on tangents. But my second one would be, off the top of your head, what would you say, and this can be either your own episodes or that you specifically wrote more of or in general, but what would you say your favourite episode of The X-Files is or was?
Gosh, I can't name just one. because there's, so, you know, as you know, like the show is so many different shows. And I think that's one of the reasons why I love the show and why it's endured, because it's not just one thing. It's probably, you know, five or six or seven different types of shows in one. And, you know, I'd say for me, in terms of the mythology, which you were talking about earlier, I think my favorite episode would be Memento Mori. And it was the only episode for which we were nominated for writing, got an Emmy nomination. But, you know, I think, gosh, I love so many of the Morgan Wong episodes. You know, I loved Home. I loved Ice. Of course, Squeeze. So many of Chris's episodes, Dwayne Barry, Postmodern Prometheus, and Vince's Bad Blood, Pusher, and then you know, everything Darren Morgan wrote. So it's a long list, I'm afraid. I can give you my top 15.
Yeah, I frequently have the same problem, really. Although I think the one that stands out for me, as fans of the show know, is Pusher, which you just mentioned.
Yes.
I just think that's an amazing hour of television. But yeah, there's so many really great ones. This sort of triggers a question by one of our listeners, Cortland, who she asked off the back of this, if there was anything recently or not so recently that you feel, having, you know, picked up or seen, that you think would have made a good X-File that didn't make it into the show or would be good for the show now?
Oh, gosh. My memory, unfortunately, is not good enough, but I have to say, I think it occurs to me every 6 or 7 weeks, there'll be something I go, that could be an X-File. It's still, after all these years, it still pops in my head, that could be an X-File episode. I remember, though, you know, there was one when the series was still on, the original series, that we tried and tried and tried to crack and we never could. And it still sort of haunts me, which was about somebody who had died. He was dead, but had come back. And he insisted there was no afterlife, there was no God, which was, you know, shaking to Scully, of course. But we just couldn't figure out the story. But I always liked that as a starting point anyway.
Oh, that would have been, yeah, like you say, especially in terms of Scully's faith and, you know, her, you know, hope that there is something beyond the other side, you know, in episodes like Beyond the Sea, where she's trying to link up with her father and things like that. And then you, wow, that would have been really good, really powerful. Yes. But I suppose it's one of those things, isn't it, where did you feel, where's the paranormal angle? Where's the investigation? Was that what, off the top, from what you remember, was that what was difficult to crack with that idea?
That was it, and also sort of what was the threat he was posing going forward, because he don't die and come back, so now what? You know, we just couldn't figure out what the next chapter was.
Yeah, I suppose that's it, isn't it? It's even though there are ideas that spark up, it's then where do they go, you know, and that's why not all of them come to be. But yeah, it's something that I know we talk about on the podcast and in the Facebook group about what kind of things feel like X-Files now, what kind of things that happen in the world that, you know, would make a good episode of the show. And in this day and age with conspiracy theory, it feels like it's there's more and more.
Yes.
Okay, my third question is, again, fairly off the top of your head, but what would you say your favourite season of The X-Files is? And again, it can be ones you've worked on or in general.
Gosh, I would have to say season 4. Because I think that was the season when the show reached maturity. I mean, there were great episodes, obviously, amazing episodes before then, and amazing episodes after. And I'm proud of every season I worked on, really. But I think season 4 was sort of when we reached the level of sophistication, not just in the storytelling, but visually. And I think what happens in the later seasons is there's sort of a tonnage from the amount of storytelling we've already done, both in the standalones and in the mythology, that makes it harder and harder to be unique and original and you know, break new ground, because you've already covered so much, right? By the end of season 4, we've done, nearly 100 episodes, and you don't want to repeat yourself. And then the mythology, which was a word that I think came around the 4th or 5th season, there's so much you have to honor and maintain. So it became more and more challenging as the show went on.
Yeah, I've always had a real soft spot for 4. I think it's up there for one of mine, really. I think it feels like when the show is really, it really understands, you know, the formula, and it really sort of runs with that, I think. So even though the challenge was coming up with new stories, it still holds up as having some really great episodes in that. I've always loved that. Although what we get a lot is season 3. A lot of people who listen to the show say season 3, which again is understandable.
Yeah, I see that too. What you're saying is right, because I think a lot of it was purely intuitive. I'm speaking for myself, but I expect it's true of everybody else too. In the first, you know, I wasn't there season 1, but certainly in season 2, and I think in season 3, we still didn't really understand what made the show tick. It was not on a conscious intellectual level, you know, on an emotional, intuitive level we did. And I think by season 4, we started to understand, oh, I see, this is what makes it work. This is the key to the show. It has to have these ingredients. And I started to realize more and more, maybe because I was a new writer as well, but that if I knew the theme of the episode, if I knew why we were telling that story, it was this huge asset, because, you know, monsters or the supernatural, if you're going to depart from literal reality to create something like that, you have to have a reason why you're doing it. There's got to be some point, or it just seems silly. And the more I could sort of consciously understand the question that each episode was posing, the more likely it was to be successful. And I grasped that by season 4.
It's one of those things that fans keep wondering about, I think, in terms of, you know, how stories are created and you know, what to do with them and where they go and things like that. We've actually got a question along those lines from Katie Doe, who says, what is your favorite storyline plot thread from your time working on The X-Files? And is there anything you would change or would have liked to redo? I suppose there's a couple of questions in there, but it's sort of off the back of what we've just been talking about, I suppose.
My favorite storyline or plot thread? Well, gosh, I can't really...
It's a big question, yeah, I suppose.
A single storyline. I'll sort of answer differently. You know, the whole Scully getting cancer idea was suggested, I think, by me at the beginning of season 4 and rejected because some people felt it was too much of a soap opera and not really the territory of the show. And I think I was arguing that we'd already seen Scully in Piper Maru and Apocrypha meet other abductees like her who had the chips in the neck and who'd come down with cancer. So I felt it was, you know, inevitable and organic to the story we'd already established that she would get cancer as well. But as I say, it was rejected. And then toward the middle of season 4, it was right before Christmas, Darren, who had left the show, was supposed to deliver one more episode as a freelancer. And 3 days before he was meant to deliver that script, he called and said, "I'm really sorry, guys. I didn't write the script. I don't have it." And we had nothing. We were completely running on fumes at that point. We're just, you know, counting on Darren's episode to come in. So that was like, all right, that's it. Scully is getting cancer. We just decided like that. We need a story. And Vince and John and I broke that episode in one day, which is incredibly unusual. Usually it takes at least 2 weeks. Mm. And then we split it in thirds, and we each wrote a third of it in like 2 days. And we had a script to prep. You know, it was pretty rough, but we had a script to prep. And then over the Christmas holiday, Chris rewrote the script, and that became Memento Mori, which, as I said, was the only one that got nominated for an Emmy for writing. So that I had a lot of fondness for that storyline as a result. I also think Milagro, which I've talked about before, felt like a very personal episode. In fact, talking about the cards, you know, Paget uses those cards, and the handwriting on those cards is mine, you know, in that episode. That's exactly the way we carded the X-Files.
Wow.
But it was about my realization at that point that I had spent as much or more time thinking about Mulder and Scully, two fictional characters, than any real person in my life. And the power of imagination and you know, where imagination bleeds into reality and how you draw that line. And so to me, that episode, that story was very much about being a writer for the X-Files.
and you know what's really interesting about that is that, and I don't know if this is something that's you've heard of before, but in my experience, more people tend to wonder if Milagro is more personal and reflects Chris Carter, whereas by the sound of it's much more your sort of your reflection and how you were feeling at the time from what you've said. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Chris wrote the script with John and me. But yeah, I remember the idea for the script coming to me just for that reason. But, you know, as I said, it was my entire life, that show, while it was going on. Mm. And you just reach a point when you realize, you know, what enormous space it's taken up in your psyche.
I just want to go back to the Scully cancer story, because there's something that I'm wondering off the back of that. We're talking about how the mythology works and how it flows through over the years. Obviously, with Memento Mori, the build-up to that takes place over Leonard Betts when she finds out at the end of a monster episode that she's got cancer, or she has an idea, thinks, maybe I've got cancer, and then Never Again is very much her, you know, way of trying to process that before we get to Memento Mori. Were those storylines already in place in a way, and were they retrofitted when the Scully cancer arc and Memento Mori came into being?
Yes. So Leonard Betts, that was an idea John and I had, and we wrote with Vince, and we had an incredibly good time writing that episode. That was one of like the happiest writing experiences in the show. We just loved that show. And we were in a competition with Glenn and Jim, who had written their second farewell episode, because one of those shows was going to be shown after the Super Bowl, which Fox had the rights to broadcast that year. And we knew that would be the highest rated episode of the series ever. And so we desperately wanted it to be Leonard Betts, and we won. So we were very happy. Sorry for Glenn, very happy for ourselves. But yes, when we decided to do Memento Mori, we knew we already had Leonard Betts, who was a cancer-eating monster. And so we retrofitted the end of Leonard Betts, which had not shot yet, so that it ends with this discovery. Leonard Betts saying, I think he says, "You have something I want," or something like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was like a happy coincidence that one could lead directly into the other. It felt, as it so often did in the X-Files, that there were these hidden patterns that we were tapping into. You know, we didn't realize, but I think it is true. Like, the better you're doing your job, you start to see things that are there in the work just to be lifted out and exposed if you look hard enough for them.
Yeah, it sounds fairly serendipitous at times in the way it all came together. Whereas, and that's I think what strikes me is that when you do a full rewatch of the series, you know, a lot of these details, they do add up, they do connect, they do make sense. Mm-hmm. There is a thread, And it's even more impressive that it's quite cohesive, even though, yeah, it was fairly serendipitous and ideas came and then they were retooled and as you just described.
Yeah, I think that, and that was the second part of the question, was about regrets. I think I can't say I have regrets, because I can honestly say that I did the very best I could do. I put everything I had into the show, and I couldn't have tried any harder. But I think what is unfortunate is that just the business of doing television, particularly at that point in TV history, sometimes intruded on the creative. So, especially as concerns the continuing storyline of the personal lives of Mulder and Scully and the conspiracy and looking for his sister, a lot of those decisions were dictated by, we didn't know whether this was going to be the last season or David was going to leave the show. And so as a result, I think that the mythology didn't have this cohesive, novelistic quality to it. And I think, looking back on it, the series finale couldn't really help but be a little disappointing, because it wasn't about the character journey Mulder and Scully were on. It wasn't about some climactic, emotional arc for the two of them. It was about answering all the questions that were left. And, plot is only as interesting as the characters who are driving it. And I think at times we became, more plot driven than I would have liked, certainly by the end.
I suppose it's a really difficult balance, though, isn't it? I mean, when you're telling such a broad story, when you've got such, ideas, and the fact, as you said earlier, that the show can go anywhere, it can be anything week in, week out, to actually keep it with that character focus at times, it must be a challenge, for something like this.
Yeah. Well, I think, I think for the standalone episodes, those clearly aren't character driven, because you could kind of, most of them, you could sort of shuffle and show in any order and it wouldn't make a difference. It's really in the mythology where I think, it sometimes hurt the show. I remember, though, at the time, we took a lot of slack, a lot of heat for the fact that Mulder and Scully didn't change enough. And people used to knock us and compare us to other shows because our characters didn't evolve. And, Chris's argument was, once you get rid of that, you get rid of the X-Files, you need that believer-skeptic dynamic. So, as you know, because you're obviously a very observant and dedicated fan of the show, we did sort of try to play with that over the years and justify her continuing skepticism, or have seasons where Mulder seemed to be playing a slightly different role. But basically, as characters, they were static in the standalone episodes.
Yeah, and some of my favorite, I mean, I love season 8. And one of the reasons that I love season 8 is because there are episodes, even standalone episodes like Badler, where Scully can't do what Mulder does. And you feel the impact of the broader character story and the mythology. Obviously at that point Mulder's gone, he's been abducted, hasn't he? So it's, you feel that weight of that, even on an episode which is about a little mystic crawling into people's bodies and causing havoc. So it was great when the show managed to fold in the two different things, really.
Well, it's nice to hear you say that, because when David was leaving the show definitively at the end of season 7, I thought, well, that's it, that's the end of the show. And Chris said, no, there's no way the Fox network will let this show go away. And I would rather continue with us than without us, to protect it as best we can. And so we proceeded. Ultimately we made this deal where David reappeared intermittently. But as it turned out, the silver lining was, after the seventh season of writing Mulder and Scully, we suddenly had a brand new dynamic to explore and a brand new character in John Doggett. And for us, for the writing staff, it was exciting and it was fun to try and figure out how to make that work. So I really enjoyed that season and loved writing for for Robert Patrick, who I thought was terrific.
Absolutely, and I think that season 8 over the years has really found a real fan base. I think at the time people did find it difficult. They did struggle with the lack of Mulder, and you know, it's like anything, isn't it? When you there's somebody you love and they go, and then the new guy comes in, there's always going to be that difficult period. But I mean, Doggett was such a well-written character and so well-performed. And I think over the years, a lot of our listeners, they frequently say how great season 8 is. And it's really, really held up over the years. So I think the choices made were really good, considering the difficult realities of production involved.
Well, thank you. It's funny because, you know, we thought a lot about that. And we anticipated that people would be mad at us and mad at Doggett. You know, like, we don't want to see you. We want Mulder back. And so that's why the first time Scully meets Doggett, she throws the water in his face. And to us, that was like the audience. You know, if they could, they would do the same thing because they don't want him there. And we thought, we'll let Scully be the surrogate for the audience, and then we'll see how graceful and mature and generous Doggett is in his reactions. And Scully can't help but like him. You know, hoping that the audience would feel the same. And I think, to a large degree, it did work. But you're exactly right. I mean, just there were a lot of people who, no matter what we'd done, if Mulder wasn't there, they were going to be disappointed. Weirdly, the ratings for the show actually went up in season 8, which was not by much. But still, they went up a little bit, which is miraculous considering we'd lost the star of our show.
It could have well been that, you know, people were curious to see what the show would look like without David Duchovny, you know, and think, wow, okay, will this even work? And
that's right.
And it did. It did. Yeah. It freshened everything up. In my opinion, it freshened everything up. And it gave it... Season 8, I often say, is the scariest season for me since the early days. Season 8 gets back to telling real horror stories and really, you know, episodes like Roadrunners,
yes,
you know, which is chilling. And it's fantastic. So it's it was a really, really good sort of semi-reboot of the idea, really. So yeah, there are a lot of fans of season 8 out there, Frank, absolutely. But speaking of characters and things like that, my next question in the 5 questions of X, which I'm getting through steadily, who would you say your favorite character in the X-Files is? And again, this can be somebody you've written for. It doesn't have to be one of the main characters either. Again, it's a big question.
Well, you know, obviously I can't include Mulder or Scully or Skinner. It's possible. You just have to say, you know, they're at the top.
It's a given. Yeah.
It's a given. But I have to say, I think I loved Krycek.
Mm.
You know, I had a great affection for all of the, all the sources, but I think especially for X, and the well manicured man. Mm. But, you know, maybe Leonard Betts actually, or Paget from Milagro, but both of them, both Paget and Leonard Betts, there was a real pathos there. I really, even though they were the quote unquote bad guys, I felt for both of them. So I think they stay with me for that reason.
Yeah, they're good examples of the kind of monsters that the X-Files did that weren't just monsters. You know, they were, you know, rounded, flawed characters. It's why I love Pusher so much, because he's a complex guy. You know, he's not a bad guy in the traditional, you know, mustache twirling sense. You know, he has deep psychological problems as to why he's doing what he's doing. So it's great. The X-Files always did that. They created quite often classic monster characters, but with very, you know, shades to them.
Yes. Yes. And I think Vince was always very, very good at that, of giving the humanity to the, well, to everybody, but to the bad guys or the monsters. You know, really, you could say any of his episodes, but Pusher for sure. You know, Drive popped into my head when you were saying that. But I think, you know, that was one of the, well, I was going to say secrets of the show, but it really wasn't a secret at all. But we felt that the more real it felt, the scarier it would be, the harder it would be for the audience to sort of dismiss what they'd seen and then turn off the lights and go to bed without being afraid, you know, without thinking about it afterwards. So part of that was, you know, we didn't tend to set the stories in big cities. We didn't tend to cast incredibly beautiful or wealthy people. We wanted to make it feel just ordinary life, and make the people, all the people, seem grounded and believable.
And that they might exist. As even in this hyper-real sort of idea, that there could be a Donny Faster next door, or there could be a, you know, yeah, a Leonard Betts in your neighborhood. It did that so well.
That's another episode I love. I love the Donny Faster episode and the ending of that episode. Oh gosh, that I remember the first time seeing that, and just it was, you know, even in the very first cut, it was just so powerful when Scully has saved herself from Donny Faster and is reunited with Mulder. And that was the only one that had nothing supernatural in it at all, other than the visions of him as the devil. But that was, you know, that's kind of a visual device. There's a funny story about that episode, which is that he was now I'm going to forget the word, but somebody who has sex with dead people. Is it a necrophilia?
Ooh, it might be, yeah.
Anyway, that's what he was described as in the first draft. And we used to get notes from the censors, the standards and practice department at Fox. And the notes on that script came back, and it was one line: "This episode is not acceptable for broadcast." It was rejected flat out because he was somebody who slept with dead bodies. So all Chris did was he changed like three words in the script so that he didn't sleep with dead people. He just was a fetishist about dead people.
Yeah.
And then the next draft was approved. So
it's a clever way of getting around it.
Yes.
Yeah, there's always been a bit of a debate in a podcast fan group about whether or not Donny Faster was a devil or he wasn't. I think the sequel Orison sort of suggests maybe he was.
Yes.
But I think if you look at Irresistible as a piece, there's a big debate as to whether or not he is or he isn't. And I'm on the fence. I don't know. And I like that. I like the fact that there's no conclusive answer. And you get that a lot in episodes, don't you, of The X-Files, where it's left open-ended and you can make your own conclusion.
That's exactly right. And I remember, though, going in a more overtly supernatural direction, Orison, than we did in the first one. So you're absolutely right.
Speaking of characters, question from Matt Latham is, and this is one that I think a few people have been interested in, and you may have gone on record about this before, but he's wondering about why the decision was made to write the Lone Gunman out. And is it something that you regretted as a staff?
You mean to write them out of the X-Files or to kill them?
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. In Jump the Shark, I think it was.
Yeah. Well, we thought the show was coming to an end. And there was huge bad blood from the studio against the actors. There was some contractual dispute. And we sided with the actors. And the studio was really unhappy with them. And we really had to fight just to bring them back for Jump the Shark. But we thought that was the end, and so we just wanted to give them, you know, a hero's out. But if we'd known it wasn't the end and that we were to keep going on, then I'm sure we wouldn't have done it.
Yeah, and obviously they did pop up then briefly in The Truth, and they've kind of popped up in the new season, or in a way a little bit, the new series.
Everybody wants them back. I loved them. Yeah.
It's just, I think, interesting that people have wondered about that. And the Lone Gunman series as well, which is something that's, I don't think people talk about as much as, you know, they should, really, because I think it was a really interesting idea to do a spin-off with them. Did you enjoy that process of the Lone Gunman series?
Oh, yeah. I think we had so much fun doing that show, because it was... The X-Files, even when it was funny, there was a certain heaviness to doing The X-Files. And with The Lone Gunman, it was lightness and joy. And we laughed a lot doing that show. And they were the most unlikely stars of a TV show. It was just a really enjoyable experience. And also working with, you know, Zuleika and Steve Sneddon and Michael McKean. And I think the problem is that show was probably 2 years too late. The X-Files had already peaked, and we were introducing the spinoff as the show itself, as the sort of the mothership was not as popular as it had been, and so it didn't really stand a chance, unfortunately. But we loved it.
Also, speaking of characters, one of our hosts and fans, Sarah Blair, she's a massive Skinner fan, and she wanted to ask whether you thought Skinner could have been used more. And if, you know, there was anything, you know, and if there was anything about his questioning loyalties that would have been done differently, or you would have changed. What are your thoughts on Skinner?
Oh, we all love Skinner. I mean, you know, there's no question the writing staff loved Skinner. And whenever he was in the show was better because he was in it. So we were always looking for ways to bring Skinner into the narrative. You know, the problem was that the standalones, it's a very clear dynamic, you know, believer skeptic. And so it wasn't always easy to figure out why you needed Skinner to tell those stories. So, you know, certainly in the mythology episodes, it was quite easy to find a reason to involve Skinner, and we usually did, if not always. But I can't say, you know, I wished we'd used him more, because I know we tried at the time to use him as much as we possibly could.
And I think he's in quite a lot of the episodes, really. I think he's, you know, and I think it was something they tried to do in the new season and put him in a little bit more, because I think, yeah, fans do love a bit of Skinner. So that does make sense. My final question, the five questions of X, is and again, this is going to be something there's a big answer to this, I suppose. But if off the top of your head, if there was a favorite moment in producing the X-Files, or something that really sticks out to you as a proud moment, or something you loved, is there anything that leaps out at you?
I had so many, you know, proud moments and happy achievements during the show. You know, obviously, obvious things like, you know, going to the Golden Globes but in the beginning, when I first started, you know, we used to go to Chris's house on a Friday night and watch the show together, and that was really nice. And, you know, toward the end, we would have screenings for the crew of the first episode of the season, which was really nice. But I think, and I've told the story before, the moment that I will never forget, and that at the time I thought it will never get better than this, and I don't think it did, was when Fight the Future opened. The studio rented a van, and they drove Chris and me around Los Angeles. We'd go from movie theater to movie theater and walk in and just see how the movie was playing with the audience. And we happened to go to the Chinese Theater in Hollywood, which is where all those, you know, hand and feet prints of the stars are in the concrete. Mm. It's very iconic. And it's a massive movie theater. I don't know, thousands of seats. And they took us to this little room that's at the back of the theater. You know, you walk up these steps, and I could just imagine Jack Warner sitting back there in the old days watching, you know, watching a movie split. And we were there, and it was the scene when Mulder and Scully are in the hallway, and Mulder is telling Scully how much he needs her, and it looks like they're going to kiss, and then, of course, when they didn't, everybody in that movie theater screamed. And I just thought, that's incredible. You know, all these people screaming because two people didn't kiss. That tells you something. So I really, that was an incredible moment.
Yeah, it just proves how much people were invested in that story by the time of Fight the Future. I remember going to watch it when I was 16 at the time, 98. And I remember going to, I was so excited. I headed in with about five of my friends who weren't X-Files mega fans. And I remember spending the journey trying to explain the mythology up to the point of the movie. And I don't know if I confused them more or I think they did. I think they got it. I think they were, you know, and I can't remember many other occasions I was so excited, because I'd been a fan for a good few years before then. I used to watch it religiously every week. And yeah, it was a great moment, that film. And it was a great film. It came out really well. And I think, you know, I'm not surprised the reaction was that way, really.
That was a great experience.
Speaking of films, there's a question from James, which is about I Want to Believe, actually. Yep. And he's interested as to why the choice was made to make I Want to Believe more of a monster of the week, in a sense, story than a mythology episode. And sort of scaling back, to some extent, the paranormality inside it.
Well, it wasn't really our choice or our decision. And you know, looking back on it, I think it's clear it was the wrong decision. You know, Chris and the studio had been engaged in some kind of legal dispute because the original intention when the show ended in 2002 was to go off and to do another movie. My expectation was we'd go right into another X-Files movie with Mulder and Scully. But because of this legal dispute between Chris and the studio, nothing happened. And I remember it finally got resolved, and the very next day there was a call. Okay, let's get working on the movie. But by this point, I think they just lost faith in the franchise, and so they didn't want to spend what they'd spent on the first movie. So they told us they wanted a scary, standalone, episodic kind of movie. And the budget wasn't very high. So we wrote a story that was very intimate, and we tried to do things we couldn't do in the TV series. Like, you could never have done a movie with all that snow and ice and stuff, you know, on a TV budget. And then I felt like, you know, whatever we could have done better, I think the studio, you know, could have done a lot better. You know, that they released it in the summer, which was obviously not a summer film, against Batman, and, you know, yeah, you got Cream. So it was hugely frustrating because I continued to believe, and continue to believe even now, X-Files and Mulder and Scully are evergreen, and you could tell stories about them forever. It's a hugely rich and valuable property for the studio, and I don't think they've treated it the way they should have.
Do you feel that if there hadn't been the legal issues, do you think there would have been a successful series of movies? And would they have been mythology based, do you think? Or would they have been a mix? They would have been mythology.
They would have been. And that's the other interesting thing, is that when they started marketing I Want to Believe, you know, I think they don't tell you these things, right? So this is me surmising, and I could be wrong, but I don't think I am. They began trying to market it as if it were an alien movie. Because I think they must have done testing at that point, showing that actually movie-going audiences especially thought The X-Files was about aliens. So it was just, it, you know, on every count, it was the wrong strategy for an X-Files feature. But, yeah, absolutely. And I had ideas. And Chris and I had spoken about the second movie and what it would be before the series ended. So it would have continued along the lines of Fight the Future. And it's a shame, you know, thinking about what could have been.
Is there anything you could tell us about that? I mean, I know there might be certain things that were used in the revival seasons or anything like that, but I mean, what in broad strokes, what were your ideas of what would you have done in a X-Files, you know, two, I suppose, you know, a sequel to Fight the Future in a way?
You know, there's actually outlines and scripts that are still out there, and so I actually don't think I can say, because I'm not 100% certain they won't resurface one day. But yeah, there was quite a lot of work done. And even after I Want to Believe, there was one executive in particular at the studio who, you know, I think kind of realized the mistake that had been made with I Want to Believe and wanted to come back. So we continued to talk about it for years, Chris and I. So, you know, you never know. So I'd hate to step on it.
No, of course, absolutely understand that, and it almost feels a little bit like the lost history of the X-Files, though, that 10-year period before the new seasons came out, and when we did have I Want to Believe, but it does feel like there's if there is such a thing as an alternate, you know, parallel universes, there's a parallel Earth out there that has the post 2002 movie series. But no, it's great that some of those ideas could one day still be in play. Do you think as well, because this is something we talk about sometimes in our group, is do you think that the show will ever be rebooted with new actors? I imagine Chris Carter would like to keep it going with David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson. And it's hard to separate Mulder and Scully from those two, obviously. But do you think it has that ability to do like they did with Star Trek, J.J. Abrams did, and reboot the idea?
Oh, yes. I think it's inevitable that's going to happen. You know, I think it's going to be a tall order. I don't think anybody will ever be David and Gillian. You know, to me, it's sort of like James Bond. I mean, Sean Connery set the standard, and, you know, I don't think anybody came close, in my judgment, until Daniel Craig came along, which was how many decades later. But I think Mulder and Scully are such iconic characters and so clearly defined, and the world of the X-Files is so rich and vast, you know, I can't imagine, especially now with Disney acquiring the assets of 20th Century Fox, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if you see, you know, X-Files land at Disneyland. Wait, you know, it could happen.
Somebody made that comment, actually, half in jest. And I said, well, yeah, you know, you might well get a time where you pretend to be Mulder and Scully looking for UFOs in a Disney world. It could happen. I don't necessarily think that's a terrible idea in a way, because I think it keeps the brand alive, and I think anything that keeps the brand alive and keeps it in people's minds, I don't always think is a bad thing, really.
If I were the head of a studio, I would do it. I don't know if I would do it now. I think David and Gillian are still, you know, in great shape, and I don't think I would give up on David and Jillian, but I can imagine in the future.
One thing that I think a lot of people have been really interested in, and when I asked for questions to put to you, this came up again and again and again, is people would love to know what you thought of the recent seasons, if you've seen them in their full. Obviously, you weren't involved in seasons 10 and 11, but... yeah, what are your thoughts? Have you seen them all? Have you got any feelings about how they went?
I have not seen all of season 11 yet. I did watch season 10. I found it really hard because, especially season 10, I found it really hard because I was really happy the show came back, really happy for the fans. But I found it hard to process my feelings because it was like, I had such a sense of investment in the show and it wasn't the show I would have done. So I couldn't really sort out my feelings about it. But then season 11, I did enjoy quite a few of the episodes. I haven't seen them all yet, but the ones I've seen, I really enjoyed. And of course I enjoyed the Darren Morgan episodes. The Darren Morgan episode in season 10, it's a funny story. I don't know if you've heard it, but Darren wrote for a short-lived series I did in 2005 called Night Stalker. And there was an episode he wrote called The M Word, about monsters, because the head of ABC, the broadcaster, said we could have no monsters in Night Stalker, which was insane. Because the original Night Stalker, all it was monsters. And he was like, no monsters. Yeah. So the script was The M Word because we weren't allowed to say the word monster. And just like on The X-Files, the first time Darren wrote a funny episode of The X-Files, the studio and the network were like, what do we do with this? Should we even make this? And the same thing happened at ABC. They didn't want to make it. And then we got canceled. And when the DVD came out, I've had Darren's script put on the DVD. I think that's the only time that's happened where you can actually download a script. If you ever find the Night Stalker DVD somewhere, it's on there. You can download it. Anyway, he took that script and reworked it as the episode in season 10. The character, the guest character wearing the seersucker suit and the hat, is an homage to Karl Kolchak, the Night Stalker character. So I was thrilled that script ended up getting produced in some way, shape, or form with Mulder and Scully.
Was that his original? I'm probably wrong here, but you mentioned earlier that there was an episode that he was going to do Darren Morgan for season 4 of the X-Files. Was that the same idea, or do you know what that idea was, or was it similar?
No, I'm certain it was not the same idea, but I don't know what it was. I don't think he ever told us what it was going to be. We didn't care what. we get an episode from whatever it is, we'll take it. It'll be great.
We'll take it. I just on the topic of Night Stalker, by the way, I genuinely feel that's one of the lost, really potentially great TV shows. I was so disappointed when that was cancelled.
Thank you very much. Love doing it. That was fun too.
Speaking of TV production, we got a question from Marlene. She wants to know, and this is something I was going to ask you as well. What's the difference between working in London and Paris now, as opposed to working in LA, Vancouver, and US production and things like that? And has it changed your your storytelling habits and your writing habits and the way you produce television?
Yes, it's very, very different. I love it, actually. I'd love to be in here and don't intend to go back to LA. LA is a giant industry with these massive multi-billion-dollar media corporations, and it functions very well, and there's a huge amount of money. And you come to Europe, and these giant multi-billion dollar corporations aren't around. It's much more like the independent film business. So there's a lot of independent producers such as my company, Big Light, and we have to put together the financing to do our shows. So it's harder in that respect, but I find it incredibly fascinating and invigorating. And I've spent so much time now in the UK, obviously, and France, and Italy, and Germany, and just learned a lot, and it's opened my eyes. And especially as an expatriate American, you go home and you look at your country through new eyes, and that helped me enormously. I think when I was creating The Man in the High Castle, being able to see America from afar and sort of talk about being American, what that means, and what freedom means, and from different points of view. So I've loved it. The other thing is that the system in Hollywood is very I would say industrial. It's almost factory-like, and I mean that in a good sense. Like a show like The X-Files, you know, you have a showrunner, you have a writer's room, and you produce a new script every 8 business days, which is pretty incredible. You know, if you think about it, those X-Files episodes, every 8 business days, there was a new one. And it was 52 to 50 pages, and it made sense. You know, it was pretty high quality. And the business is not organized that way here. You know, they tend to write most or all of the scripts before they even start filming. And they have a much longer development period before they go into production. So that's one thing that I've been trying to change is to bring the best practices from Hollywood writers' rooms to writers in the UK and elsewhere. And as I said, teaching in Berlin for the past 5 years, because this is it's the most exciting time in television across the world, certainly in America, but I would say even more so in Europe, because I think there's opportunities now for writers and for audiences here that never existed before. So it's a great time to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a really great time for television. And it's I suppose it's afforded you the chance to make things like the Medici series that have more of a Euro-centric feeling as well, and are able to cover, you know, stuff, something that, you know, not necessarily have been made in the same way in the United States, I guess, as well.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's a show that would not have been made in the United States. And it's not a subject I would have been asked to tackle in the United States. And I've loved it, you know, and I found, you know, weirdly that actually writing history, historical drama, has a lot in common with writing science fiction, because, you know, we tend to think of history as this perfect record. Well, it's not. There's all kinds of gaps and things we just don't know, and you have to fill those in. And I was talking earlier about how by season 4 of The X-Files, I'd kind of figured out why I was telling these stories. And that's the same thing with historical drama. You have to know why you're telling the story. And I've really enjoyed it, and I've learned a lot. You know, also just sort of, you know, the way British people think about themselves and about the world, and French people and Italian people and so on. You know, you have to go in with a certain humility and keep your eyes and ears open, and you learn. And it's incredibly enriching, you know, just as a writer and as a person.
Yeah, and I think that really comes off on screen as well. And speaking of the Medici series, was it quite a thrill to collaborate with Nicholas Meyer? Because I'm a huge fan of his from the days of, you know, Star Trek II, Time After Time, things like that. Was it a fun process working with him on that?
Oh, yes. I mean, you were talking about going to opening night of Fight the Future. For me, going to opening night of Star Trek II was like that. I mean, I was so excited. And then the movie was fantastic. So, you know, Nick was one of my heroes, truly one of my heroes growing up, not just because of Star Trek, although certainly because of Star Trek, but also because of Time After Time and the 7% Solution. Mm-hmm. So, you know, now he's become one of my closest friends. And, you know, I can't believe it, because I really do think so much of who I am as a storyteller comes from having watched and read his stories when I was growing up. And so it's not surprising, actually, that we have a very compatible, you know, point of view, because, you know, I learned from him. So yeah, it's a thrill.
It's a great master to to learn from there, I think. So obviously there's a new Medici series coming up very soon, isn't there? The Magnificent. That must be exciting to see about to come to fruition.
Yeah, it's great. It's coming. That'll be on Italian television in October, and then on Netflix in December. And that it's interesting, because the first season of Medici was about Cosimo and his father Giovanni, played by Dustin Hoffman. That was like the first generation. And now we've skipped forward 2 generations to Lorenzo, who's known as Lorenzo the Magnificent. It was probably the greatest Medici of them all. And it's an incredibly dramatic story. And it's a 2-season show. So, you know, with half the story will be told in the season coming up this fall. And we're just starting shooting now in about 3 weeks' time on the continuation of that story, which will be broadcast a year later.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, so yeah, there's going to be more. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
I'm going to finish then on one final question, which sort of goes back to the X-Files and the X-Files now, really. And this sort of feeds off something one of our group members, Jeremy, says, in that What do you think about conspiracy culture right now in terms of, you know, how it's folded a little bit into the X-Files revival and how the X-Files is relevant again in this day and age? Do you feel that there is a place for the show, and how do you feel it fits really with the world today?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, X-Files traded in conspiracy theories. It was our bread and butter, but we didn't invent it. You know, we were actually sort of tapping into tradition that for us, for Chris and my generation, was really filmmaking of the 1970s. You know, All the President's Men and The Parallax View and 3 Days of the Condor, movies like that were in our minds, or even the original Night Stalker TV movie. But now it's become mainstream. It's become the culture. You've got, you know, the President of the United States spouting conspiracy theories. And I think the thing about the X-Files, though, that gets lost is that Mulder and Scully were after the truth. You know, they were after the truth. The truth is out there, and they were characters of great integrity. And Scully was a scientist. And while Mulder was a conspiracy theorist, he respected Scully and respected science. And that, I think, is the worrying part, is when people are so caught up in conspiracy theories that they lose any respect or regard for objective truth. And, you know, and I recognize there's a lot of truths that cannot be known, but it still must be acknowledged that truth is a core value, that's something we're all seeking. Mm. And I think that's the thing that needs to be recovered, that sense of the primacy of truth, and that we all value that. Because without that as a common accepted standard, you know, it's hopeless. You'll never get anywhere. You'll never solve any problems or agree with anyone.
I suppose as well, finally, could you ever see yourself writing The X-Files again, writing Mulder and Scully again? Do you think it would ever happen?
I absolutely could see it. I absolutely would do it. I don't know how likely it is to happen. I think you know, it didn't happen on the last two seasons, unfortunately. It just didn't work out. But, you know, I love the show. It holds a very special place in my heart, and I still feel the same passion for it now that I felt all along. It hasn't dimmed in the slightest. So it would be very easy for me, very comfortable to go back into that world. I think, you know, I wouldn't do it unless I felt like I have something new to say, but I actually feel like I have a lot to say. And I think, you know, that's why I continue to have so much faith in the X-Files as a title, is I just think it's endless, and it is a vehicle for storytelling. And those two characters in that world are rich like few things are.
Yeah, I absolutely, absolutely true. I think I can speak on behalf of a lot of fans, Frank, that much as they've really enjoyed the two seasons and, you know, appreciate everyone involved, I think you were missed, definitely. And I think people would love to see you back if that ever was to happen, if the stars aligned. But
I missed doing it. Sorry I wasn't able to.
Yeah, you don't have to apologize. You've got some amazing stuff that you're doing. But no, I think I just wanted you to know that, because there's a lot of people have said that, you know, they really love your episodes and love your involvement in the show. So if you are back one day, great. That'd be a great hero's welcome back for you. But yeah, well, thank you so much for coming on and talking to me today. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah.
Is there anywhere you would like to direct people to, where they can find out more about you, more about Big Light, what you're up to, things like that online that you want to push them towards?
Well, yeah, at the moment they can go to the Big Light website, which is simply biglight.com. And sometime in the next 6 to 12 months, there'll be a frankspotnitz.com. That's sort of under construction right now. But in the meantime, yeah, Big Light's got, you know, everything about our shows and what we're doing.
Perfect. That's fantastic. Go and check it out, guys. You know all our social media details. They'll be in the credits. But yeah, once again, a big thank you to Frank. And we will be back very soon for more episodes. But until then, as always, trust no one. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast is produced and presented by Tony Black, alongside a dedicated group of podcasters and X-Files fans. You can find us on Twitter at The X-Cast, and on Facebook if you type in The X-Cast, or at our group, X-Files Basement, an X-Cast podcast fan group, where you can continue the discussion about all things Mulder and Scully. If you want to support The X-Cast further, you can now subscribe and become a patron of the show on Patreon, On Google, just type patreon.com/thexcast. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. You'll see all of our tiers, subscription options and perks, which include early access to episodes, bonus content such as commentaries on X-Files episodes, access to a patron chat zone, and even appearing on one of our patron roundtable discussions. We would appreciate any support you can give the show, so just go to patreon.com/thexcast to find out more. Our title music is provided courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at I am Will A Y E.